podcast. And this is Dave Graney speaking. Unfortunately, we have no Elizabeth McCarthy today. She will be back next week, I'm sure. But today we have, because otherwise, if it's me just doing the show, it's rather like a fellow with one paddle in a canoe. Tony Martin, you must have that experience sometimes. Have you ever done a show by yourself?
I used to do Midnight to Dawns in New Zealand.
Midnight to Dawn is good. I think that's permissible.
You just play what you want. Nobody cares. I don't think there's even ratings at that time.
Padding around the studio by yourself at night.
Yeah. And
being stalked by lonely women out there in the New Zealand night.
There was never any play Misty for me sort of action, sadly. But there's...
Were you hoping for that?
Well, yeah. Well, the callers are all insane. They're the kind of people that call you at 3 a.m.
Yeah. I listen to ABC sometimes late at night, and you have a great feeling that everybody in the world's drunk.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. Well, have you ever done the party show here on Triple R?
I have heard it. It's very impressive roll call of guests. Yes.
That's great. I know, Headley. I always point out the first time I heard the party show, his guests were Gareth Evans and Zag. I don't know how he got them together.
Yeah. One was Zig.
Oh, that's right. I don't know. I can never remember which was the one that turned evil. You don't want to defame the other one.
Gareth.
Yeah. He had the pointy hat on. But if you do the party show, I go on to talk about movies generally a couple of times a year. And the callers are I don't want to defame the callers, but they're mostly off their nuts.
Defame them, Tony.
But there's nothing funnier than somebody who's off their nut trying to describe the plot of a movie, any movie. Like, it's actually very hard, even when you're straight, to just describe a movie. If someone says to you, what is the story of that film you just saw?
And you're normal.
Yeah. It's very hard to describe it. So you get people calling up going, saw this film, Johnny Suede. And you go, well, what was the plot of that? Brad Pitt's in a bath and he knows Nick Cave. It's just describe the plot of a film. Mm. It's good fun. But I love the party show.
Mm. But sometimes you listen to people in the daytime doing a radio show by themselves.
Yeah.
And it seems odd.
It's a hard thing to do. Yeah. It's a skill.
Yeah, I don't know how they do it. Yeah. I always feel them just, you know, like your expression, you can feel the gears turning. You know?
Well, they tell you to focus on an imaginary listener. To think about some friend of yours who you would like to be talking to if they were here, and just pretend that you're talking to that person.
I never do that. Should I be doing that, Tony?
You could give it a crack. Have you done a show? Do you ever have to do it just on your own? But you'd be
like
good at that.
I don't like it, Tony. We have Brian here panelling, but he refuses to talk.
Nothing. He's writing at the moment. Not even interested in what's going on.
Tony, he's a sparky. He's keeping the whole spaceship flying.
Good.
If we distract him, we'll all fall to earth.
And what exactly is my... What sort of demands have you got here? What does Elizabeth do,
Tony,
that I can do?
As we have just started talking, and I didn't introduce you because you need no introduction.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Am I in that category now? I don't know about that.
I thought I'd try it off.
Okay.
How would you introduce yourself to the listeners?
I just say, I usually say Tony Martin, and then I have to qualify it by saying not.
You don't have to.
No, there's often not on Triple R, maybe not. There's confusion at the moment because of a German cyclist, apparently.
Right.
Who I've seen photos of. He looks like the man who was in Thunderbird 5.
Yes.
And he's on SBS all the time cycling. So I'll just be walking through the room and I'll hang, Tony Martin's done it again. You're going, what? And so I'm getting a lot of that.
The lounge singer Tony Martin.
He was great.
Albums. Yes,
he was great. He was
the 60s.
Way back earlier, I think, than that.
50s. Yeah.
He was in the Marx Brothers movie, The Big Store.
Oh yeah.
And this is how twisted my mother is. She's got framed on...
Don't defame your mother, Tony.
She's in another country. Oh. But she's got framed on the wall at home. She's got a blow-up of a review of the Marx Brothers Big Store from the New Zealand Listener magazine. And it says, this late period Marx Brothers film is ruined by the constant appearances of Tony Martin. Do you think that's hilarious?
Oh, dear. Has that made your... book, which is coming out later in the year?
The Nest of Occasionals. No, that's not in there, but there is going to be
I would have put that in there.
Well, I'm trying not to offend any of my relatives, but there is going to be trouble. I know there's going to be a lot of trouble when this book comes out.
Your mother isn't like the mother in The Sopranos.
She is, actually.
Oh,
she is quite similar to Livia Soprano.
Manipulative.
In a sort of, in a smaller scale kind of way. She's not taken out a hit on any of her children that I'm aware of. But
Tony, you're defaming your mother even more.
She said, well, yeah, that is a bit unfair, Livia Soprano. Yeah. But
what about wasn't there an quite, what's the word, political, mother in I, Claudius?
Now, I've never seen I, Cladvus, as we used to call it at school. I've never seen that. Is that? It's really good, though, isn't it?
It is very good. Derek Jacobi, John Hurt.
But it's all on sort of really cheap Doctor Who kind of sets.
Yeah, and that gives it, in video, and it gives it that air of of dreamlike kind of boringness that makes the evil terrible.
Okay, I want to look at that.
You would have seen Caligula, Gore Vidal's Caligula, though.
I have seen Caligula, and someone
lots more tits and ass in that.
Well, there's the version. I saw it when it came out at the movies.
I saw it at the drive-in,
but that was the censored version that came out.
The windscreen kept fogging up.
Really, just on the cut version.
And this character who we knew kept yelling out, "Has anybody got the horn yet?"
Really?
He plays a bit part in that horrible movie, Dogs in Space.
Well, the Caligula was Bob Guccione from Penthouse magazine.
All the greats were in that film. Why didn't it work, Tony?
Well, the thing is, Graham Wood, one of our greatest cinematographers, once slung me the uncensored version.
Oh, good.
Which is, because it's directed by Tinto Brass, I think, and... But then someone else came in. Guccione wasn't happy that there was enough hardcore sex.
For our listeners, Guccione published Penthouse magazine, and I would say won the pubic wars of the 70s against his arch rival, the more girl next door, Hugh Hefner.
Well, Hugh Hefner was like publishing, short stories by John Updike in Playboy magazine. There was none of that for Bob Guccione.
I loved Hugh Hefner used to have pages of the Playboy philosophy in the 70s magazines. It was like Thoughts of Chairman Mao.
Right. Well, I remember you telling me about a TV show did.
Playboy After Dark, yes.
But that sounds like a great show.
You can see it on YouTube. You see Hef there standing around with Sammy Davis Jr., in his dressing gown, he goes, "Sammy, now we got the Grateful Dead.
Right.
Out of sight." And they turn around and it's in his lounge room and the Grateful Dead are playing a song of theirs. And Jerry's very funny. Jerry Garcia is always very funny. Yes. But anyway, why did it fail?
Oh, well, I don't know. I always remember the famous joke that appeared on the show Not the 9 o'clock News, where they said that... Sir John Gielgud was shocked when he saw Caligula. There was no mention of all the sex and violence when he read the original paycheck.
Yes.
And that was, I think, what happened, because there was Helen Mirren was in it.
Malcolm McDowell.
Peter O'Toole. Mm. And they shot this film, and then Guccione saw the rushes and went, "It's not blue enough." So he had hardcore porno filmmakers come in and shoot like close-up inserts.
That is like old school Hollywood. Should be more of that going on. What if he had made that movie Australia or something like that?
Man, did you see
that rocking? Yeah.
Did you see that?
I didn't. I heard some people say it was very good, though.
Some people say it was, and it was massively successful as well.
And quite an audience in Australia ready to damn it before they saw it. And I must admit, I joined that chorus joyfully.
I thought I'd go and see it and give it a fair shake. But to me, it was like Baz Luhrmann had invented a machine for slowing down time. It was like you'd be sitting there, it was 2 hours in, and you look at your watch, and then you look at your watch, what you thought was half an hour later, and 6 minutes had elapsed.
In the future, you'll be able to sit in the cinema and you'll be able to press a button to Guccione-ize it.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. This is boring. Guccione.
Just more penetration shots at that point. But it was very, it was a very odd movie, Australia. If you actually look at it sort of coldly, it was a very unusual film. There was like, for example, I don't want to spoil it, but Brian Brown, just to switch off now for the next 30 seconds if you don't know what's going to happen, Brian Brown is the main bad guy. he gets killed in a montage. Like, there's just a montage of newspaper headlines, and one of them is Brian Brown killed by crocodile, and that's the last of him in the movie. There's a bit where they're going through the desert, and they've run out of everything, and they're going, the only way we can get the cattle there in time is to go through this desert that nobody has ever been through before. And it's like there's a huge build-up. 45 seconds later, there's like... and everyone rolls into town. Fine, got through the desert, no problem. We didn't even see that bit. Presumably an hour has been cut out. It's a very unusual structure. And a lot of, like, the first 5 minutes of Australia has so much narration and captions and supers. Like, Baz Luhrmann doesn't trust you to... He's such a control freak. He wants to tell you exactly what you're thinking at every moment. See, I feel like I'm against the tide here because people love this movie, don't they?
Right, yes.
Am I just being
Tony, you are
anti-Australian?
I think so.
Is that what I'm being?
Yes, it's part of your New Zealand nature, your otherworldliness.
Well, maybe he'll make New Zealand one day.
We're going to start off playing some music, Tony, by one of your Kiwi mates.
Who have
accepted into Australian life, Mike Rudd, who came over here with the Chants from New Zealand with another character who went on to form the Lardy Das, and then he was with the Fantastic Spectrum, the Incredible Mertzeps and Ariel. And Spectrum have revived recent years. Have you ever seen Spectrum playing around? They are one of the greatest R&B, prog rock guitar bands, and Mike's voice is spectacular. But they've put out a new CD.
A new one.
And Mike doesn't write a lot of songs, but he's written this one. It's very fresh. And Mike Rudd has written this song on Spectrum's new CD, Breathing Space 2, and it's called Xavier Rudd Is Not My Son. As the acoustic guitar genius of Bert Jansch on a 1965 recording. Bert, mainly an instrumental performer. When he does write lyrics, they're always really great, and that's Soho. And before that, we heard the guitar and lyrical genius of Kim Salmon from his album Ernest, his only acoustic guitar record, aside from the ones he did after that with the Darling Downs. And Kim... Salmon is doing some solo gigs very occasionally around the place, and if you ever see it, it's really, really great performance he does, performing songs from... he draws across such a wide wide career, from songs from Antenna and the Beasts of Bourbon, and that was a song from the Beasts of Bourbon era called Cool Fire, and he does his shows with an electric guitar, and he's also working on a new Kim Salmon and the Surrealists album. And we started off with an acoustic song. What was that one, Brian?
Kim Salmon.
Yeah, we had Kim Salmon, and then we had the Xavier Rudd Is Not My Son from Spectrum. Sorry about that. And we're going to hear a few announcements now, and then we'll come back with myself, Dave Graney, and guest Tony Martin here on Banana Lounge Broadcasting.
Sunshine. Moonlight. Times. Triple R Boogie.
And now we're back on Banana Lounge Broadcasting. We have Tony Martin in guesting today. Elizabeth McCarthy is otherwise engaged.
Yes.
And Tony, you've brought in a song you wish to play from the new album from Root! Exclamation mark.
Yes, Root's second album, Surface Paradise, is out now. And if you buy it now, you get a fantastic bonus second CD called First Root, which is all early demos.
It's quite sexual allusions in the language with the First Root and Root! Exclamation mark, Tony.
It's a bit Bob Guccione.
It's not gardening, I think they're getting at.
I don't think so. It's quite a concept album, this.
But it is a kind of rootsy sound they have, as opposed to the previous band, allegedly.
Yeah, there is some connection to This Is Serious Mum. I'm not sure what it is, but there is some vague connection there.
Yes.
I'm not allowed to say too much.
Yeah, I think one of them walked past a rehearsal room that Tism was allegedly inside of
something
at one point.
Yeah, I can't say too much. But the track I've selected is certainly one that I think Melbourne listeners will enjoy. It's called Crown Tower Blues.
Okay. That was a song by Victoria Gay here on Banana Lounge Broadcasting with a false ending, which I like the song up until that part, comrades. But we were all set up to come back on air, and then there was that last bit that tricked us. And before that, we heard the Kez Band, who had many false endings in the one song, which made me very tense. But perhaps that's the Kez Band's evil design, to lull us into a sense of soft mellowness with their beautiful instrumental sounds. That's on their new album, Kez Band 2. Very unknowable band, the Kez Band, and very enjoyable. And we began with a song from Root with Crown Tower Blues. And we're on BLB today with our guest, Tony Martin. And the last track, Tony, we were mentioning earlier that you have a New Zealand background.
Mm.
The last band, Victoria Gay, is Vicky Gay Phillip and Jeff Raglis with Ross McLennan on bass and Noel Crombie on drums.
Oh, Noel Crombie, yes.
He is a man with form. Could you please explain some of that?
Well, I guess most people would know him as the man who played the spoons in Split Enz for many years. But he was really the architect of the look that Split Enz had. And I always remember a friend of mine had a newspaper article which was Split Enz arriving in Los Angeles in the late 70s, and they all had that wacky hair, which Noel used to design.
Yeah.
And the caption said, Noel Crombie sporting the apparently very common down under helicopter hair, which is where your hair went up for about a foot and then just splayed outwards like blades.
Yes.
And apparently that was considered to be like some sort of New Zealand tradition that he was maintaining there. But I remember when Split Enz broke up, you know, everyone said, we're going to do this and we're going to have a band and we're going to do this and we're going to do that.
Yeah.
And Noel said he was starting his own fashion label called The House of Crombie.
Mm.
And I don't know if that ever happened, but he does show up.
That sounds good, doesn't it?
The House of Crombie. Mm. I'd buy something I'm wearing. Is that House of Crombie you're wearing? But he, I think, designed the set for Spicks and Specks and I remember the old the Continental, the much-missed Continental. He designed all of the bar, all of the decor there. I mean, he designs things. Props for films, I think, he creates as well. But he's kind of a genius.
Yeah. And he played drums. He wasn't their original drummer. He just played spoons and they had a drummer.
Yeah.
And then he took over drums at some point and then Paul Hester kicked him out of there.
That's right. And then Noel was a percussionist. And then later he was in Schnell Fenster with Phil Judd.
Yeah, Phil Judd is still active in music and has a website and all that sort of thing. And now New Zealand is quite an exotic place for us Australians, Tony.
Right.
Many lovable, strange things come out of New Zealand. I was watching Flight of the Conchords the other night. Do you ever watch that show?
I love that show, yeah.
When they had the New Zealand Prime Minister in it.
Hilarious.
And because the two characters had been hoodwinked by their manager into a gig as Simon and Garfunkel tribute act called Sage and Parsley.
Yes.
And he was also their manager works at the New Zealand consulate. So, and the Prime Minister was coming and he wanted to meet Barack Obama. And of course, he was from such an insignificant Pacific nation that Barack Obama didn't have the time. So the manager hired a Barack Obama impersonator to come to the barbecue.
And the Concords were required to be bodyguards, but Murray pointed out that the army has the gun. So they couldn't have a gun. The army's got it.
And the Prime Minister's getting Barack to pose for photos with for his daughters and stuff. It was
And the New Zealand Prime Minister just really wanted to get a copy of The Matrix on DVD because it hasn't come out in New Zealand yet. He was back last night in last night's episode.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Which was called New Zealand Town, which was about New Zealand's attempt to create a section of New York between Little Italy and Chinatown called New Zealand Town.
It's very New Zealand sense of itself has some kind of self-mocking nature, but it's quite, they kind of enjoy it.
And I like the way Australians are sort of portrayed in the show. There was an episode recently where one of them was dating an Australian, and so all of the friends and families of everyone, you know, didn't want to have anything to do with them because it was like an interracial marriage. I love that stuff.
Yes, and There's a film on part of the film festival which is about the Top Twins, those strange characters from New Zealand.
They have been around since I was a kid.
It goes through their 25-year history.
Wow.
25-year career. They showed a bit of their show here. They're quite strange and exotic at first to look at, but they were comparable to Barry Humphries in the way they, because their TV show, they just went through all these different areas of New Zealand society,
right.
including themselves playing these mad farmers that were chasing them around looking for
right.
wives and stuff.
Funny. They came out of, there was a period, New Zealand now has a big comedy scene, obviously the Concords, and there's a comedy festival in Wellington, there's one in Auckland, but in the early 80s, there was just no comedy. There was literally no live comedy venue. So the only way you could do comedy was either to do what I did, which was to get into amateur theatre and be in like Alan Ayckbourn plays or something like that, or to come up with something musical so that you could play support to a band. And that was the only way, the only comedy, the first sort of comedy performance I did was to impersonate John Cooper Clarke. Mm-hmm. Do you remember John Cooper Clarke?
Yes, yeah.
Got to interview him a couple of years ago. Looks exactly the same.
I know, yes. Yeah.
And but I'd seen him at the Glue Pot Tavern in Ponsonby in Auckland doing his show where he just wore a black suit and he had a reel-to-reel tape recorder and he just did his sort of poetry over a sort of beatbox.
He's a fantastic performer.
Amazing. And so I came back, I just went and got a suit and got a wig and just looked somehow exactly like him. And showed up at the Glue Pot Tavern with a reel-to-reel and a sort of beatbox backing. And I think I did like a 4 or 5 minute act, which was just me doing Eagles songs as John Cooper Clarke just doing, rolling down the road, trying to loosen my load. I got 7 women on my mind. And that was the only way you could do comedy was to be on a part of a band
bill. You had to find an audience.
Yeah.
Is that what the funny nature of like the original Flight of the Conchords on radio, they're always billed as a comedy.
Yeah, that's right.
Comedy band.
Folk paradise.
Comedy music thing.
The Top Twins, they came from the same thing. So they had to support bands and so they were musical. And so it's kind of, they have a kind of a foot in each camp.
It would have been very tough. I remember Los Trios Ring Barkers used to occasionally open for hunters and collectors. And
right.
The audience would just be baying for their blood from the beginning. And that's before the Hunters and Collectors blue singlet period.
Right. If you ever had comedy on before, it's a tricky thing to do. Albert Brooks does a great stand-up routine about opening for bands.
We had a poet open for us once, Peter Bukowski. I think he's actually launching a new book on Friday night, actually, at the Hill of Content. But yeah, we're at the Continental, and I wanted to have like a very arty, like have some Melbourne art involved.
Right.
And we had the audience was a sold out crowd, and Peter just got out of hospital from open heart surgery, and just did all these poems about being operated on, having a chest full of lights and stuff. And people were it was like hardcore. People were
freaked out,
repulsed, and they didn't know how to do. They didn't know if you talk when someone's quietly reading a poem. You know, it's rude, and that was tough. Other times we used to do a song called Morrison Floor Show, and we wanted to get the lead singer of the Australian Doors Show to open for us, so
right.
we could have Jim Morrison acoustic on our posters.
Right,
And we hired We had an actor in Sydney who came on as Drunk Jim, and he came out with mirror shades and he couldn't see anything, so he kept knocking everything over. It was a big show, and people are yelling out, you know, "You're not Jim. Jim wouldn't say that." And he couldn't find the microphone. In Melbourne, we had Malcolm Hill, who did Revolutionary Jim. Like, "Anybody come out? Anybody going to love my ass?" And that was quite confronting.
Well, you mentioned Los Trios. So I always say that they inadvertently started the comedy scene in New Zealand, because I remember in 1983 they came to Auckland and performed at a pub called the Windsor Castle in Parnell, and it was the first time that anyone had seen comedy in a pub, and it was like the invention of the wheel. You could see people
going...
They
had a very...
quite a confrontational...
Slapstick kind of... image.
They chucked bananas and suntan lotion at the audience, but you could see people going, hang on, so you can come to a pub and see something that isn't music. It was like, and that was it. And within, I think, a year, there was a comedy venue in Auckland. So good on them.
Yeah. Now, Tony, I was talking with my friend Kim Salmon and a few other people the other day, and they alerted me, because you had your last book out called Lolly Scramble.
Yes. Still in print.
What is Lolly Scramble?
Well, Lolly Scramble is a phrase which I thought was just a New Zealand phrase, but apparently it's in Tasmania as well, which is where lollies are thrown into the air and children fight for them. Like Santa Claus would have a Lolly Scramble.
Yeah, we often have mocking conversations about Tasmanians as well as New Zealand. They're almost honorary New Zealanders, those Tasmanians.
Well, there's certain phrases like that which... which have made it as far as Tasmania, but not as far as the mainland.
But then I've been alerted to this world of New Zealand confectionery.
Right. What have we got?
Have you ever heard of perky bananas?
Yeah, that's like a little yellow banana shape.
That seems normal to you.
Yeah, that's what's wrong with
that. Would you like
that?
A perky banana?
Yeah, why not?
What sounds odd to my sophisticated Australian ears?
The home of Hubba Bubba.
A buzz bar?
A buzz bar, I know these, but I haven't lived there for 25.
A choc fish.
Yeah, chocolate fish. That's as New Zealand as it gets.
Chocolate fish doesn't seem odd to you?
That's got marshmallow, pink marshmallow in a chocolate fish-shaped fish.
It's fish, Tony, and chocolate.
The
two don't go together.
Now that you mention it. Because, I mean, in New Zealand you would buy this at the dairy.
Yes,
which
of
is
course,
the milk bar.
Of
people,
course,
people laugh about that. They go, the dairy. Well, where do you milk the cows then at the sandwich shop? You hear that, and then you go, hang on, what do you call it? The milk bar. That's unusual when you think about it. The milk bar, really?
Yes, and in our shops, I have noticed green and black chocolate. It's like indie chocolate from New Zealand.
Oh. That
green one? And black. It's green.
Is that what it's called?
Yes, green and black.
Oh, that's
like
something
you
new.
Know from your neighbourhood chocolatier, but
that's not traditional like chocolate fish.
It's Cadbury's, Tony.
Right. Okay.
Who have bought this little indie struggling chocolate shop and fronting.
Do Cadbury's make the flake? They make the flake.
They make everything. Yeah.
Because in New Zealand we for years had the luxury flake. Do you have that's here now, isn't it? Which is a flake covered in a coat of chocolate.
Really?
So it's a hard chocolate bar and you bite into it, flake on the inside.
So after you have your main course of chocolate fish, you have your chocolate.
Exactly. Mm. Chocolate is a good description for the luxury flake.
Toasties, pinkies.
I'm not sure what a pinky is, but we did have that, yeah.
Pineapple lumps.
Yeah, pineapple lumps. That's something you should check for and then go to a clinic, I think.
Astronauts.
Don't know what that is.
Assorted fruit puffs.
Oh, no.
Mm. What about the drink L&P?
Yeah, L&P. Now, that stands for lemon and pyrore, which is an unusual name because it's from...
That sounds something off of Angel. They went to the planet Pyrore, I think.
Did they? How was that? It's spelled P-A-E-R-O-A, and it's a town called Pyrore. And they make a drink, which is basically like Solo, lemon-flavoured fizzy drink called Lemon and Pyrore, which is like calling something, I don't know, Orange and Bendigo. It's an odd name. But the best story I know about that is if you go to Pyrore, there's a giant... a bottle of lemon and pyrore, which sounds exciting until you go there. It's just a giant bottle. That's all it is, three-story bottle.
This drink has a billing on the label, L&P, world famous in New Zealand.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably meant to be a joke.
That's almost a poem. The New Zealand regard for itself is almost as strong as the Italians' love of themselves.
But on the weekends in the town of Pyrore, you used to see hoons going down to the giant bottle of lemon and pyrrole and just doing wheelies round and round the bottle. And my favourite photo I ever saw...
Such a quaint country.
They had a flood where the whole town was underwater, like up to the first story of the shops.
Yes.
And the same hoons got a speedboat and went down to as much of the lemon and pyrrole bottle as was sticking out of the water and did wheelies in a speedboat around the bottle. That was pretty impressive.
Now, they did go to the planet Pyrrole on Angel. It was the planet that the green demon Lorn came from. Lorn could empathise people's minds if they sang a song. He was a lounge singing demon.
Sounds great.
But on the planet Pyrrhor, they hated music, and all he had to do if they started attacking him was start to sing a Sinatra tune. And, very sophisticated show, Angel.
And what would he bust out? What would he do? I get no kick. A bit of that.
Isn't Sinatra great? Even Sinatra impersonators, especially Phil Hartman.
Phil Hartman and, sad to say, Joe Piscopo both did a superb Frank Sinatra.
They're never up on YouTube, are they? Because Saturday Night Live pulls everything.
Saturday Night Live are very strict on policing YouTube for clips, but if you can ever see any of Phil Hartman, the one where he picks a fight with Billy Idol, I pick chunks of guys like you out of my stool.
And when he's having a go at Bono and what's her name? Sinead O'Connor.
Sinead O'Connor.
I'm talking to you, Zippy.
That is fantastic. The one where the best one is where he's recording duets.
Oh, yeah.
And he's send them in two at a time. And he's just like busting off one or two verses and sending them out.
Then there's the tribute show when the Andrews sisters come to just suck up to him.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we love you, Frank.
And leg goes, up.
Didn't I bang you two broads at the Brown Derby back in 45?
Yeah, Phil Hartman, I think Piscopo did a better Sinatra, but Phil Hartman did a funnier Sinatra.
Oh, he was great. Everything he did was great. He was the voice of a character on The Simpsons.
So. He was the voice of Troy McClure and I think McBain and Lionel Hutz.
Did he check out the same way in the same room as the much-missed Chris Farley?
No, Phil Hartman was like the straightest, squarest guy. You never heard a single bad word about Phil Hartman. He was like one of the few people that everyone loved. And he was shot in the head by his own wife while he was asleep.
Jeez.
Because she was on some gear.
I'm referring to Chris Farley checking into a hotel room, disappearing in a blizzard of hookers and cocaine.
That's right. I was actually in New York when that happened. Mm. And I remember waking up and... There was the, what do you call the thing out the front of the dairy with what's in the newspaper? We call that a hoarding thing that says what's in the paper. And said Chris Farley dead, and the whole of New York City was quiet. Mm. Like people were just walking up the street not speaking.
Mm.
It was eerie.
Mm.
But he was very, very fat.
Yes, he was. Very amusing.
Very fat. Possibly the funniest man ever, I think, in terms of just someone who you just look at them and you start laughing. Very Chris funny. Farley in any sketch gets
his
me laughing.
His talk show is he used to do when he'd get...
The Chris Farley show.
Yeah, he'd get Paul McCartney on. He'd go, you know when you were in the Beatles?
That's right.
That was awesome. And then had no more questions.
And then my favourite thing he did was Matt Foley.
Oh, the
motivational speaker who lives in a van down by the river.
I ran into a friend, a musician in Coffs Harbour last year.
Right.
And I said, where are you living? He goes, I'm living in a van down by the river.
Really?
And I started laughing my head off. He goes, it's called The Gallows.
Well, that was Matt Foley. And that was here's a trivia fact for comedy nerds. That character was written and created by Bob Odenkirk. There you go. Who you can imagine playing that.
Who's Bob Odenkirk?
Bob Odenkirk from Mr. Show with him and David Cross were a comedy duo. He was Larry Sanders' manager on the Larry Sanders show. And I think he directed a film recently called...
Are there comedy nerds?
There are comedy nerds.
Really?
Yeah.
Are they like the guys in... I really love that TV show, The Big Bang Theory.
I haven't seen that.
It's a flat full of nerds.
Yeah.
It's very amusing.
But they're like IT kind of...
Yes, yes.
See, I look like... See, I don't know anything about computers, but I know about old comedy programs.
they're very odd, and their sexuality is pre-pubescent.
It's generally, you know, assumed that nerds... get no sense.
That's what a lot of the laughs in are about. Now, we've been talking for a long time here on BLB. And we're going to play a few announcements here. Oh, we're going to play some music now on Banana Lounge Broadcasting. I get many texts and emails about this song. It's Here We Go Magic with Tunnel Vision. That's the Bakelite Age with their song Crawling Around the Cellar. Before that, we heard I Heart Hiroshima. Do you think they mean us to say... It's the heart, Tony, or I love Hiroshima. What do you think?
I think it's ambiguous. I think yes. It's up to the listener to decide.
All these people are playing with me today. Are they? You know, the false endings and all that, Tony. I don't like it.
Playing with your mind.
Yes. Before that, we heard the X, and there's three X's in their name.
Right.
And Simon out the front called it the XXX. Is that right? Or?
Well, it could be triple X.
Or
see,
the
we
X's.
Could be. Obviously, their fans will be furious
they're
right
young,
now.
They're young people from England, so you can never trust them, Tony.
No,
they're always up to something.
Yeah.
And that was called Islands. And we started out with a Banana Lounge fave, Here We Go Magic, with a song called Tunnel Vision. And Brian tells me he knows what's going on in music, Tony. They
right.
come from Brooklyn, which is a mythical place, Tony. Many sad young men with beards with acoustic guitars.
Come from Brooklyn.
Playing music, yes.
Which, if you're from New Zealand, you know Brooklyn as the home of Welcome Back Cotter. That's all I know about the place. Although it's kind of a cool place for authors to live. You know, Paul Auster would probably
yes.
live there. Michael Chabon would live there.
He's a brilliant writer, Paul Auster.
Jonathan Safran
Foer. Surely Paul Auster would live half the year in Paris.
He probably would, just enigmatically chasing
they
a faceless man up a street.
You write regularly on the scrivenersfancy.com.
That's right.
People can access this via the magic box, Tony.
It's a website. our subheading is lowbrow commentary in elegant surrounds. It's very snootily devoted to the written word, and everyone works for free. So there's no... The ads are non-profit, so you can visit there without feeling that you're part of some commercial venture.
And you change the content every week or so?
Every week we have four columns, and we have a guest columnist, the visiting scrivener. Sean McAuliffe has done it. There's a great one up there at the moment, up there on the front page till tonight, by a man called Michael Witherford, who is a novelist. He used to be in a band called the Fish John West Reject, and he's taken a very interesting look at this case involving alleged... music
yes.
plagiarism with the Down Under
yeah.
song. We can't really comment on that because it's before the courts, but he's gone through the history of music plagiarism cases. Very interesting reading at thescrivenersfancy.com.
And have you got something up there at the moment yourself?
My first visit to a TAB ever, I overheard a betting tip in the street and took a punt on it, and what happened is up there. But there's an interesting column if you happen to see me on a Sean McAuliffe program talking about your generation a few weeks ago, where I stood on what I thought was a plastic truck day, turned out to be an Optimus Prime Transformer, and there was fury and outrage on the internet. People calling me up going, type your name into Twitter, and people were going, Tony Martin has trampled on my childhood. Doesn't he realise what he's done? And so I compiled all of the Twitters.
So it's not an electrical transformer, it's a toy.
But yeah, no, that's right. It's a robot that turns into a truck, Dave.
Get a life.
It's before our
people
time.
Out there.
Well, I didn't want to put it that way, but if you read the column, you can...
Are these people that wear nappies and shit themselves?
I don't know. Quite possibly. Because
I enjoyed that once in my life. And
really?
Hope to again.
During your time in the space program.
Yeah. Well, that's why, Tony, I have this rational fear of the Beatles, because it may trigger a fall-through episode.
Really? Well, don't play any Beatles.
No.
Be careful.
I have to avoid them all day, every day. And it's a terrible trial to do that.
Well,
try it.
Well, good luck. Hey, Dave, we've got to get you to write something for
yeah,
the Scrivener's
like to,
Fancy
yeah.
at some point, because I do enjoy, and I know you'd be too modest to plug your own blog, but you do quite an elaborate blog on your...
Sometimes I do, yeah.
On your MySpace page.
I've had a bit of stress in my life this year, so I'm finding it difficult to tune into that playful tone
right,
of detachment
see.
You need, Tony.
Okay.
But I put something up on Facebook, and Facebook is different from MySpace.
Do you have a Facebook and a MySpace?
Yeah, you have to have all that
right.
jazz when you're a performer, yeah.
Right.
And, Facebook is, you know, like people think it's a chat room or something.
So is it like Hefner v. Guccione?
I think it is, yeah.
And so do you fall into a different mode of writing when you're...
I think you have to, yeah.
When you're writing for one and not the other?
Yeah. People are more... For me, there's more musicians on MySpace, even though it's quite, it's like a derelict world.
Yeah,
probably.
Right. Well, this is about for
more
our
people are on Facebook, I think.
Our old radio show, Get This, there's something like 6 or 7 or 9 or 10 moribund Get This related MySpace pages, which confronting to visit.
They're still very active. I saw on somebody online writing, Get This, you know, to replace Kyle Sandilands. You know, someone's out there to get Tony Martin on the job.
Not on my watch, says Guy Dobson. I love how he started using that as a phrase, not on my watch. Yeah. You're going, ratings, not on my watch. Not while I'm in chat. Not while I'm on the board will there be any ratings.
Mm, yes.
But I'd hello to all the Get This fans on the internet, because they, at one point there was an illegal version of our podcast. Unauthorized version.
Yeah.
Somebody took all our podcasts and put them onto iTunes without our permission, using all of our artwork. Mm. I didn't even know about it, and was up there for about a year. And at one point, it was getting more downloads than all of the actual Triple M podcasts that were actually current.
Yeah.
This was a year later. So the listeners just, they keep flying the flag, Dave.
Bravo,
it's amazing.
Tony. People love that show. Now, we're going to play a bit more music, Tony. We have to play a few sponsorship announcements.
Yes.
And I was going to play a long jazz track, but Jessica does the show after us, and she will take care of that part of the proceedings.
Okay.
Let's hear some announcements, I think.
Be subscribed.
No, they went off on a tangent.
This is an electro version.
Now, on Thursday at Yah Yah's, there's going to be a gig which features three talents, which you're going to hear some music of now. First is Claire Moore, who's going to be appearing with Kay Louise Patterson.
Oh, yes.
And so we're going to hear a song from Claire Moore, very rare performance from Claire Moore. She's going to be playing as part of a trio with Kay Louise Patterson and Rosie Westbrook on bass. And we'll hear us Claire's sci-fi epic from her album Liquor, which accompanied my album Hashish. And her song is a nightmare vision of today's world, which she has called Tomorrow's Incorporated. It's Jeff Williams in the Clear Spaceman with Answer Your Phone from the new album Outerlude. And before that, Kay Louise Patterson with her song Blue Dog Walking, and before that, Claire Moore with Tomorrow Incorporated. And all those artists are playing at Yah Yah's on Thursday night. Yah Yah's is up the formerly the communist end of Smith Street towards the Gertrude Street corner. It used to be only for homeless people and communists up that end, Tony. It's changed.
And comedians occasionally.
Oh, right.
It was where the last laugh was.
Right, ah.
And the joke in the old days. I don't know what it is now.
Well, comedians, like musicians, need a sense of balance in their view of the world, don't you think, Tony? Serious communism and homelessness outside. Laughter inside.
You've got, in that pie graph, you've got to leave a big slice for bitterness,
find. Oh, yes. A little leavening of bitterness.
Sure.
Yes. Bittersweet.
Absolutely.
Now, it's the film festival at the moment, Tony. Are you in festival fever mode?
I really want to see the documentary about Walter Murch, which is showing at Acme at some point. But often what happens is I'll see a film and I'll go, but that's going to come out at the movies.
Yes,
I really want to see In the Loop.
Doesn't always happen, Tony.
Well, I think it will with In the Loop.
Last year there was a brilliant movie about the musicians who made all of the Phil Spector recordings, and like they were on every record made in Los Angeles through Beach Boys, Johnny Rivers, called The Wrecking Crew.
No sign.
Brilliant. No, never been seen on DVD or on television or seen again.
One for the team at Umbrella or Madman to get onto, I would have thought.
It's funny, there's a film out at the moment I wanted to ask you called the new Michael Mann movie.
Oh, yes, like Public Enemies.
Public Enemies. Michael Mann movies are always state of the art, kind of in the sound and the filming and everything, of a Hollywood movie. Hollywood movies are incredibly overblown.
Absolutely. That's why we love them.
We live in a world where we have to endure Matthew McConaughey, you know, posters on bus stops.
Well, he's gone over to chick flicks now.
Yeah, years ago, he would have been strictly drive-in only movies.
Absolutely.
And he'd never be invading your everyday life. But
no.
you know,
it's been downhill since Dazed and Confused for McConaughey, as far as I'm concerned.
That was a great movie, Dazed and Confused.
It was a great film.
Great soundtrack. Really, even the everybody's haircuts was perfect for 1976.
You know why? Because it's almost impossible to make a movie set in the 70s without it looking like you're taking the piss.
Yes.
Without it seeming like a parody.
Yeah, well, unless it's made by a person who has a real personal, relationship with that time. Like I got out of a movie, out of a DVD called Starkweather, because it's one of the first kind of irrational mass killers in America.
Oh, right, yeah.
Charlie Starkweather in the late 50s, like, just went onto a school rooftop and started shooting people.
Yes.
Inspired the movie, in a way, Badlands by Terrence Malick.
And also Peter Bogdanovich's Targets.
Yes.
Slightly inspired by that.
But those films had a feeling for the time and the place. But this one was comically like a modern day psychobilly music band who was only ever heard the Cramps, but never heard all the stuff that the Cramps were inspired by.
Right, you know, right.
It was like an advert. I was wondering whether Public Enemies would be like. The original film about John Dillinger had a real feeling for the kind of Depression era and that kind of failed farming agricultural towns that he comes from. Because I see the shorts and it looks like these huge American cities that he's walking through.
It looks very stylized. The problem I have with Michael Mann is he's gone over to video. He's said, right, video is the future. And, of course, he made beautiful-looking movies on film, like Heat, of course.
Yes.
And then he did that one with Tom Cruise called Collateral, which was, I think, 80% of it was shot on video. And the advantage with shooting it on video at nighttime is you don't have to light the street. So you can point a camera down a street. If you shoot a city street at nighttime, you've got to set a whole bunch of lights up, or it's just going to be darkness. But on video, you could make out it had a particular look, but essentially it looked like video. And to me, whenever they went to one of the scenes in that film that was on film, it looked 100 times better. But man's gone, nah, video's the future. So he's made that awful Miami Vice.
Yeah.
Which was
the
like
film.
The film of Miami Vice, which was entirely shot on video and just looked like an episode of Cops.
Mm. Well, he made the original series of Miami Vice.
Which was way better.
Great series, yeah.
And the problem you have
full of strangeness, series.
But movies are full of strangeness and exaggeration. Even the most naturalistic movie is an artificial piece of work, and it's stylized, and movie acting, even at its best, is exaggerated, and something about video equates with realism. So when you shoot something on video, it looks like it's really happening. So if you take, say some movie acting from Heat, for example, shot on film, and then you were to shoot it on video like Neighbours, it would look ridiculous. It would look exaggerated, and to me, that's what Miami Vice looked like. Now he's done it again in Public Enemies. The shorts are very quickly cut together, but when you see the movie, it's on tape, and it looks like video. It looks like an episode of Cops, but because it's set in the 30s, that adds an extra level of oddness, because it's a modern idiom, shooting things on videotape, but from the past. Looks ridiculous to me. I don't know if it's just me.
I think at certain times, certain times are linked to other times, you know, in their obsessions. Like in the 70s, people were obsessed with the 30s.
That's right.
And that produced great movies like Chinatown.
Yeah.
And They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
And bad films like Lucky Lady, of course.
I don't know, the 80s was more like a 50s period where they made those Back to the Future and that kind of bad movies in a way, but kind of good movies, I guess, the Back to the Future ones.
The first one, certainly.
You mentioned Peter Bogdanovich, his big hit movie, The Last Picture Show.
Superb.
He made with his wife, who was the art director, and the thing that it's like a tragedy. His life is tragedy in many ways, Bogdanovich, because they were partnership making great movies, and she gave that film her life because it was her hometown
that
they filmed it in.
Right.
She gave it the feeling, and he fell in love with the leading lady.
He certainly did.
Whilst making the film.
Oh, dude.
And then dropped his wife. And
my God.
Nothing much has happened to him since. He appears in The Wire No, he appears in The Sopranos.
He's Dr. I can't pronounce it. Kupferberg or
the
somebody.
The psychiatrist goes to see him in the series.
And he got to direct an episode. And he's someone who, even though he was bombastic and full of himself during the 70s, I feel quite affectionate towards Peter Bogdanovich. Yeah. Whenever he does a commentary track on a film, wearing usually an ascot or a cravat, he has a lot to say. And he did do this amazing thing. He did a book you can still get called Who the Devil Made It, where in the 60s, before he was a filmmaker, he was a film critic, and he used to write monographs on people like John Ford and Howard Hawks. And he decided just off his own bat to go and interview a lot of these guys before they died. And he got some of the only interviews with, I think the only interview I've ever seen with Leo McCary, who made The Awful Truth and some of the Marx Brothers movies, and I think maybe did those films with Bing Crosby as a priest. And he was in an iron lung and could only speak for about 20 minutes a day, and Bogdanovich would show up every day and just get whatever he could onto tape. And that is an amazing book, Who the Devil Made It. And his book, This Is Orson Welles, which is kind of his version of the Truffaut-Hitchcock book, if you like. It's just a marathon interview with Orson Welles, who, of course, is lying a good percentage of the time. But
Peter Bogdanovich was... He was also presenting movies in that kind of art house, repertory cinema thing.
Museums
in LA.
He's
a very interesting character. And you mentioned the movie Targets before.
That's a great... Well, that's his first proper film as director.
Which features, is it the last performance of Boris Karloff?
It was. I think it was about his fifth to last, but it was his last great performance. Mm-hmm. And what Roger Corman did is he said to Bogdanovich, look, I've got... if you can direct a film, if you can use these elements, I've got Karloff owes me 2 days. So if you can come up with something for Karloff to do in 2 days. Plus, I've got about 20 minutes of footage from a film called The Terror. So therefore, with the Karloff stuff and the footage I've got, you should only have to be able to shoot half an hour and that should be a movie. And with those constraints, Bogdanovich and, you mentioned, his wife, Polly Platt, came up with an incredible film, really. It's a film that contrasts the horror of Boris Karloff's world with the real-life horror of Charlie Starkweather on the top of a building just shooting people with a gun. And the scene where he's just... It's one of the scariest scenes you've ever seen in a film, where the guy is just sitting on the top of a roadside petrol tank just shooting people on a freeway with a telescopic rifle. And you realize that when that happens... There's no cops around. A guy can do that for hours before anyone notices what's going on, and it's as scary as anything you've ever seen.
Yes, it's a very, very good film. And it's amazing the skills of Hollywood that were available and that he brought into play to make a film under those kind of constraints. And as opposed to modern-day American Hollywood films, which begin with a deal being made with a $20 million star to get to sew all the things together, you get a certain actor in a film and a film gets made.
It's a package.
Yes, it's usually kind of a distorted, you know, and the end result is distorted by the competing kind of things pulling it in different directions.
And also, someone once said to me, the reason Hollywood movies are so bad is because the first thing they think of is the release date. They would go, we want a film of the A-Team. It has to come out on the 31st of May next year. Who's going to be in it? And then further down the track, what about a script?
If you want to find out more about Peter Bogdanovich, we were hinting at the tragic life. He made a film after leaving his wife for the lead actress in
Sybil
Shepherd. Then he became besotted. He made a movie about a Playboy model, Dorothy Stratton. He made a movie about her. She was murdered by her boyfriend. I think he was married to her as well. And then he married her younger sister.
Yeah, that's right.
And she had plastic surgery to look more like her older sister.
Oh, my God.
But he's still out there punching, Tony.
He is. He is. He came to Australia about 5 years ago and made a telly movie about Natalie Wood. The Natalie Wood story. He also, here's a movie, he did From Sir With Love 2. Yes. Serious, I think straight to video. But he is still punching.
Yes. We're going to play a bit more music now. We're going to play a film-related song. This is Across 110th Street from a what they call disparagingly a blaxploitation film, but a sort of song that was taken by Quentin Tarantino, and he based one of his my favorite movie of Quentin Tarantino, Jackie Brown.
Yeah, great.
And this song almost inspires the whole film, and it's by a brilliant Bobby Womack, and Across 110th Street. It's a fantastic Burt Jentsch and John Renborn from a 1965 recording in their Chelsea flat, and it's you can get it. It's called Burt Jentsch and John Renborn, Burt and John. They weren't big at putting themselves forward in those days, Tony. No bells and whistles there. That was called Piano Tune. Before that, we heard the fantastic Bobby Womack with Across 110th Street. Thanks to Tony Martin for coming in today. Up to anything at the minute, Tony?
Just working on the website. And
That's the scrivenersfancy.com.
That's right. And also Sam Pang, who does breakfast on this very station, I've been working with him on a new show called ADBC for SBS. Which is a show about history, something I know nothing about.
Is this with Chris Taylor as well?
No. It's Sam Pang and the only regulars who are on every week are Sam Pang and Friendy, who people might know as one of the original penis puppeteers. Yeah.
He hasn't had a terrible accident, Friendy.
I hope not.
He hasn't had to
actually has
put
had
the
a terrible,
tools away.
He has had a terrible accident, but not in that department. Oh. I know he did a... hammy? Is that something that you can do in sports?
I think you can do it by pulling your penis and scrotum around.
I don't think it's work-related in this instance.
Perhaps when he was on the skateboard and his friend was pulling him across the stage by his penis.
I can honestly say that I was there the night that he was doing the skateboard and being propelled across the stage by Mr. Methane.
That was amazing. He was making sails out of his scrotum.
While the wind was being
supplied
by Mr. Methane.
I never enjoyed that kind of cavalier disregard to one's magic wand, Tony.
No, I can only imagine that the long-term effects of an act like that would be catastrophic.
He's going to regret it.
I don't think there's going to be any little friendies. I don't want to imply that because
I, Tony, will one day be marching out to bat one day at Lord's, so to speak.
Sure.
Bat in hand, balls present.
Well, that's right. I'm not getting involved in the, as I understand it, 9 franchised productions of that show. But there's none of that in ADBC. I don't want to
drag it down there.
It's a show about history. You're being told something.
Now we're going to play a few more sponsorships, Tony, and then we're going to go and come and say goodbye in a moment.
Done.
Okay, it's goodbye from Banana Lounge Broadcasting here. Where are those gunshots, Brian? I love to hear them as we leave the building. It gives me a feeling of warmth. Cover me, Tony. I'll go first.
All right, I'll be here.
Thanks to Tony Martin for being with us today.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks to Brian Driscoll for manning the... desk, and look out for my gig at August 14th at the Arts Centre. You can get tickets online. People haven't been rushing, so please rush and book a ticket for the Arts Centre. Dave Graney, Knock Yourself Out launch. Up next is Jessica. See you later. Elizabeth will be back next week.